Welcome to Third and Fairfax, the podcast of the Writers Guild of America West. I'm your host, Brian Gary. Episode 97 has Hilliard Guess, hailing from the Screenwriters Rant Room, interviewing Tob Rob Smith about the development of his limited series on FX, The Assassination of Gianni Versace. Hilliard caught up with Tom at his offices in London via Skype.
Hey, what's up, everybody? It's Hilliard Guess, and you guys are listening to Third and Fairfax. I am here today with executive producer himself, writer Tom Rob Smith of the new FX series, The Assassination of Gianni Versace. What's happening, Tom? Welcome to the show.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Absolutely, absolutely. So let's just go ahead and get right in. Let's tell everybody where you're from, you know, and how you got into the game. Obviously, you have an accent, so you're from somewhere, right?
Yeah, my mom is Swedish. My dad is English. Born in London. I wrote a show called London Spy, which caught people's eye. And that was the thing that got me over to the States.
Well, let me just ask you this, because one of the things I love is how. So can you tell us a little bit, can you back up a little bit more? What are the steps that got you to that point?
Yeah, I mean, all the steps of this. Like, I started out working on long-running shows in London, I did straight from university.
Right.
I then got a job working on Cambodia's first ever soap opera. So I went and lived in Phnom Penh for 7 months. I was storylining that, and that was really amazing experience. So I came back from that, and I wrote a novel called Child 44. Mm-hmm. I wrote it without an advance, so I used the savings that I'd sort of built up in when I was living abroad and came back and wrote the novel. That novel did well, got bought, got optioned, got turned into a movie with Tom Hardy, Gary Oldman, and that's actually how I got to know the producers of American Crime Story. So Brad Simpson and Neil Jacobson, they really like the novel, and that's our first point of contact. And we'd always stayed in touch, and we were always having lunch or dinner or whatever, but never found anything. And so I carried on writing some books and written 4 books, and then wrote my first TV series, original TV series, London Spy. And Brad and Nina really liked it and has a lot of thematic connections, I guess, to Gianni Versace. And so that was the driver.
You produced and created a show over there too. Now, what's the difference creating a show there and creating a show here? Is it pretty much the same thing? Do you guys have a writer's room there? You know, how does it work out there in London?
I mean, it's less writer room in London than it is in the States. Mm-hmm. It was 5 episodes. It was with Ben Whishaw, Jim Broadbent, Charlotte Rampling. And I just had this idea that I knew wouldn't work as a book. I knew this idea for this piece was driven by this character played by Ben Whishaw.
Right.
And I was he's just not a literary. I couldn't imagine what his literary voice was, but I could see him as a person. So I was this story has to be told by someone visually. And so that was the driver to tell it as a TV. I knew it was going to get made as a film. It was kind of edgy, and I don't know. The main character is gay. It's hard to get that kind of stuff funded. There was no kind of, it was just this, it was at the center of it was a gay relationship, and there was no kind of, let's mix in other strands and try and, sell it to everyone. It was this is what it's about. So you're following this character. And the BBC were amazing. They never gave any pushback on that. They put it on a primetime slot. Mm-hmm. And so that was how it came about. It was just the 5 episodes, and I wrote them all. And that was the connection between that piece and American Crime Story.
Right. And one of the things I've noticed, I'm a huge, fan of most things that are British anyway. And I love, you were just saying that the BBC gave you guys a chance, even though it was a lead LGBT character, right? And that's one of the things I notice about BBC shows, and maybe it's just, because of the way you guys do things over there. But, even with ethnic diversity, you guys are so far ahead of diversity than we ever have been. Whenever I watch shows there's leads in all kind of roles, you know, over there, you know. And it's like we're just catching up in the last 4 or 5 years, in my opinion, you know, from the shows that I watch, you know.
It's interesting. Yeah, I mean, you know, we get a lot of, you know, from the perspective here, we get a lot of criticism that, for example, we don't have representation in that is as good as the States. So actually we get the reverse criticism. I think it's always when you're looking at from afar, you see the good. And then when you're close, you kind of see the mistakes. There are definitely lots of gaps. Right. Here, there's a lot more work to be done, but I think the BBC genuinely is, you know, they want to tell great stories. I think the word diversity is such a funny word. I'm like, it's just a ground. I see it as like really interesting stories. That's right. What it was. And with London Spy, I wasn't like, oh, you know, there's a underrepresentation of gay characters. I was like, there's just this story, this character is needs this, the whole context of it. Yeah. And I was like, it's just a great story. And so when you pitch it like that to the BBC, they were like, yeah, I can see that. And right. And that's how it came about. But, you know, FX were amazing on American Crime Story. I mean, you know, I think the assassination of Versace is really edgy and pushing all the boundaries. And FX never once said anything other than go for it. I mean, yeah. They were really incredible. I think FX and the BBC were, I mean, I just think I've been really lucky. I think they're amazing, both amazing creative homes.
Mm-hmm. I think it helps having, you know, Ryan Murphy and his team. You know, nobody's going to say no to Ryan. But let me ask you this. Now, jumping over to Gianni Versace, it's interesting because as we both, I'm a gay man too, right? I'm actually the vice chair of the LGBT committee at the Writers Guild, as well as the Black committee. And I'm sorry?
I said yes.
Oh, sorry.
Right.
And
affirmation.
Yeah, and one of the things that we are always talking about on the committee and, you know, just in the community itself is, you know, our representation out there, which is kind of where you were going. And when I heard they were going to do the Gianni Versace, I was like, oh, no. Are they – just hear me out. I'll back this up in a minute. I was like, oh, no. Now, you know, that's all we need is for, you know, straight society to see us as a serial killer, right? Because we already had Dahmer, et cetera, et cetera. And I watched the pilot, and I've watched them all, but I was so blown away with it regardless that I got over that pretty quickly. You know what I mean? Was there any pushback or talk on that between you and Ryan and the guys over there?
You know, the interesting thing about it as a story is like, yes, the killer is gay, but the victims are predominantly gay too. And these victims are extraordinary, amazing people. And Versace, obviously, who is like world famous, but the not famous people were completely extraordinary. I found David Madison. It was this lovely guy who came out to his parents, lived in a small town called Barron outside of Minneapolis. They ran a hardware store. He like embodied love and aspiration. Someone struggling at that time to be both out and successful. Mm-hmm. You can contrast that with Jeff Trow. I mean, this guy, his whole dream was to be in the U.S. Marine, I mean, the U.S. Navy, right. And struggling with the fact that he was gay. And then recording that interview for CBS, where he's criticizing the policy of excluding gays from the military way ahead of his time, right. With huge risk to his dream and no real upside for him. I mean, right. Extraordinary act of courage. And that video, you can kind of see it. Mm-hmm. So, you know, to me, it was always very, in fact, it was balanced. It was, you know, there were far more brilliant gay men in the piece than there were tortured and destructive ones. So to me, that never arose as a question. Okay. I was like, and I also thought, you know, I want the full range of stories. I don't want to just feel like the only story you can tell is a story where, you know, gay people are great. I was like, right. The best characters are the messed up people. I want the broken people, the people that do crazy stuff as well. I want the whole range.
Right.
And we get to tell this whole range. We get to tell this person. And Andrew himself isn't a serial killer. He's a spree killer. He's someone who basically, we're watching this crisis, identity crisis, this person descend from promise and brilliance into insanity and murder. So it's a very different profile to someone who is just inflicting pain upon people. Yeah. Like, I mean, if you've gone back and met Andrew, age 19, 20, and his friends, and you said, by the way, this guy's going to kill people in a horrific way, and so they wouldn't have believed you. Mm. They would have been like, that's impossible. Andrew is gentle and kind and attentive. So I was like, this story is... it's just a rich human story full of all kinds of different things. And I, you know, I feel like that's part of the excitement of that representation.
Right. Interesting. It's funny because I was thinking about how, you know, and first of all, I agree with you that you probably shouldn't even have to worry about those type of things. You're just trying to write a great show. And I think that, you know, I deal with the same thing, you know, in the black community also, in regard to there's just not enough. So when you see one, it's like, oh, shit, that's the only one representing us. You know what I mean? So I was trying to say to you that was my initial thought. But going in and watching the show and the acting is so amazing. And the writing is so amazing. I'm just, I forgot immediately, you know, about all of my, you know, worries, if you will. You know what I mean?
I think that's the point, I think, that is really tricky, and I can't get around that. It's just, because there's so few,
right.
You're like, this is the one we get. Whereas, you know, if you get like a thousand, it doesn't matter if one person is this kind of crazy narcissist. It's like if you just get the crazy narcissist, you're like, that's all I got. But actually, this show, in a weird way, this show embodied the range. That was what was so great about it, is that you got the Versace. Versace is this... you know, genius who came out in the 90s where no one was out, really. It's funny, we had a scene, we were talking about it, like, when they're discussing who might the next victim be after Versace, like, who's he going to kill next? And there was a list, we had to drop a list, because the FBI did this, they drop a list of famous out celebrities who Andrew might go for next. The list was tiny. And there was this sense of, wow, this is it. It was like Elton John, Barney Frank. It was like, that was it. I mean, it was really, really amazing. And I actually was like, I have read Barney Frank's, his autobiography.
Mm-hmm.
And I listened to him on the X-Files, actually. And it was when I listened to him, actually, not when I read his book. But he described gay people as one of the most despised groups in society. And when he said it, I was like, it took my breath away. Right. So I was like, I don't think of myself like that. Mm-hmm. And he didn't say it like he was like, oh, you know, I want sympathy or anything. He said it very matter-of-factly, almost under his breath. He just said it, and like, this is how I was growing up, and this is what I was dealing with. And I was listening to it, I was walking around, I think, I stopped, and I was like, wow, that's true. He grew up, and he forged this amazing career whilst holding that sense of who he was. And, and I feel like that there's a pressure to kind of somehow not address that sadness, and I feel like this show was we were able to go into what that does to people. Mm-hmm. I feel like that, and it does lots of things. Like, actually, it makes some people great, like Barney Frank. It doesn't just damage them. Like that can be very sharpening. And I think, you know, some of the things that are discussed in the show, and this notion of shame and this sadness, I feel it myself, and I feel like it's part of the creative thing. It can be a driver of positive stuff.
Right. Let's talk about research and the actual like writing of the scripts. Did you write all of them?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, and then there was a co-writer on episode 8, Maggie Cohen.
Right.
Brilliant.
So let's talk about your like how you work. Like you got this project, like what were your steps like leading up to, you know, getting the scripts out for the production?
My number one thing is to read everything. It's like all the thinking, like the writing to me, I'm pretty fast when I'm writing, but I need to have spent a lot of time thinking about it.
Right.
And so I think they sent me the books before OJ hadn't even been announced, so I didn't even know. They were just like, we're doing this thing, this anthology series, American Crime. One of the seasons might be this, if we can pull it off. What do you think of this book? And so I had it in my brain for a long time. I'd read Maureen's book so many times. I knew it backwards and forwards. And when I met her, I was like, for the first time at the TCAs, I was like, I know all your phrases inside and out. It's a weird thing of meeting someone who is a stranger to you, but you really feel like you have this connection to them because you just know them. And you feel like you know them. It's not necessarily true, but it feels true. We really got on. I think she's a wonderful person. I think it was, couldn't have run the book, the show without her book. And just getting all that information in your head and thinking, what is this story? And it's such a strange story. Which bits of it really interest me? Which bits of it could be really powerful? Seeing it in units. And then I think that Maureen's book doesn't spend as much time on Versace as we do. And so we wanted to get into Versace much more. And I read literally everything that had been published about him, which sounds like a real brag, but I'm surprised at how little there was published about him. He's underwritten about, and that was interesting to me, like considering what a genius and what a pioneer he was. I kind of, I feel like he's been dismissed a little.
Right. Interesting. So, so when you were breaking down the scripts, what did you guys decide, like, for instance, with the pilot that you would focus on? I don't want to spoil alert, by the way, but did you decide, like, on we're going to focus on the murder, you know, and then backtrack? And then how do you decide, like, what and which way and order you're going to go if you go an episode or two you never even show Gianni? You know what I mean? How do you decide that?
Yeah, it was Ryan was really clear on this. Ryan was like, the only thing people know is the murder of Versace. Right. And it's like, and he's absolutely, he is absolutely right, which is you got to start at that point where, you know, it's a journey into the unknown, the story. So you start in familiar territory. Mm-hmm. And I remember going into FX at the very beginning, and I was talking to Gina Bailey-Ann and just saying, there's this incredible character, the father of Andrew Cunanan, and he's just this extraordinary figure. You can't understand Andrew without understanding the father, and you can't understand him without telling the story of him in San Diego and National City. You know, got to do that story. It's like, it's absolutely, but I was like, you can't start there. No one understands any of that. No one knows who Andrew is. No one knows who this dad is. You're going to have like a young 7-year-old Cunanan. I mean, it was just like, the audience would be spend all their time trying to figure out what the story is and not looking at the kind of small character details that are going to ripple into the larger thing. So I was like, that get pushed to the side. Obviously, that story can't go first. It's like, what do people know? People know the steps of Miami. Yeah. So the kind of analogy that we have is it was like saying, we're going to take apart the engine. People have seen the shell of this crime. This is the crime that everyone saw the outer shell, but no one saw the engine. Mm-hmm. And so we're going to take this car apart bit by bit. And that was the kind of approach we took.
Interesting. Yeah, I was fascinated by that. Like every episode that opens, you know, sometimes you're not even with Andrew for a while, you know. And that is fascinating to me. But you're still totally engrossed in what's happening. And then again, you'll backtrack and show us how we got to that point. You know what I mean? So to me, that's just brilliant writing to me, you know.
I mean, you know, that comes out of the book. I mean, all of these decisions really come out of the source material. And the source material, I remember being completely compelled by Andrew up until the point he killed. And then I was like, he just becomes this horrendous force of destruction. And in some ways, he kind of plateaus. Like, he doesn't really change. He just sort of, he tells stories with his murders, but he himself has kind of crossed a line. And he is like this point of destruction. Mm-hmm. And it's the victims who have the really powerful emotional stories. Mm-hmm. So you have a strange structure where you have your main character, Andrew, is compelling and interesting when he's struggling as a young man and with various things, sexuality, his identity across race, social class, all that kind of stuff is really fascinating. And then it stops because he doesn't, in a sense, he stops becoming human. He becomes this kind of monstrous figure. Yeah. And what happens is the victims take over. So how do you, you know, it's like a strange, you know, there's a halfway mark where your main character drops off completely and you no longer feel sympathy for them, and then sympathy swaps. So that was the sense that if you start with Versace, like Versace is the main sort of life force at the beginning of the show, and he's the person that people are coming to, and then you're going back through those victims, and Andrew doesn't really become a main character towards the end of the series when people understand what he's done. So you're not trying to sympathize with him, you're trying to understand how he got to where we saw him at the beginning.
Right. And speaking of Andrew, I noticed that the pilot, usually there's a gap between the pilot and, you know, episode one. But I did notice in particular, the character got focused in a way that I almost was taking it that I was telling my husband, we were watching, I think, episode 3 like a week ago or something. And what I was telling him about it, I was like, you notice a difference? And he said, what? And I says, he's almost become a robot to himself. It's a weird thing. And I don't know if that was on the page or if that was a character choice, but it's brilliant. And it's so subtle, you know, in the way it was done, that to me, it had to have been on the page. Can you talk about that character development a little bit?
You're talking about the fact that once he starts killing, like the shift from human right. to, yeah. I think what is really terrifying about the Cunanan crimes is that his murders are full of meaning. Hmm. Like, his murders are full of storytelling.
Right.
It's like he's given up trying to impress the world through his own abilities, and now he's like, I'm going to kill this person, I'm going to tell a story with this killing. Mm-hmm. And that is particularly true with Lee Miglin, and it's particularly true with Versace. It's like, yeah, these are his attempts to talk to the world. And it's, I mean, I find the murders really, you know, you can see someone's life, you can see someone's existence as a means for you just to articulate something to the world is to me mind-boggling. Mm-hmm. And you're right, there is a kind of, I mean, the dehumanization there is terrifying. And your phrase is robotic. That there's that sense that your humanity has left you, that mm-hmm. you can't see this person and see them as a person, but you see them as this object that you're then talking to everyone with, a platform almost.
Right.
I mean, episode 3 is really, you know, that's a random killing. The things he does to Lee are horrific.
Yeah.
And we only saw a tiny fragment of what he did.
Wow. Yeah, I was just blown away with, like, wherever he went in any situation, he would always, it's I guess the reason why I was calling him a serial killer is because a lot of serial killers will have a certain MO, you know? So I was wondering if some of his MO was being, having an idea and a plan of what he wants to do. And if the plan adjusts, you can see his mind thinking, you know, like in that episode in particular, he's sitting there at the park and he just found out about that the car has the phone issue, right? And he's calculating, who am I going to get? Who am I going to get? You know, and you're almost in his body. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And so I'm one of those guys. I'm always curious of, like, how does that play on the page? How do you keep that tension, you know, going? You know, you see it in the screen, but how is it played on the page? You know what I mean? So that's what I was drawn to a lot.
Yeah, I mean, I think, again, that comes from, you know, the literal source material, you know, reading Maureen's book. What happens is she's describing that part. There's a lot of detail because we know quite a lot about that part, because Andrew did go into that national park in New Jersey. He did go up to someone and, you know, ask for a map, and he did sit on there's a car park, and he sat on this bank. And he was sort of pretending to read a, you know, like a leaflet about the national park, but really he's assessing everyone coming in and out and seeing who he could pick off.
Right.
And it's just terrifying. And it's just a guy sitting on a bank. I mean, you go into any national park, they'll be full of people. And this person, he's pretending to be the tourist interested in the world. And the weird thing is, but, you know, a year earlier, he would have been that person. He would have been the geek who was interested in all the history that was going on. I think it was the same to do with the Civil War. And no, I think there, I mean, just when you put yourself in that situation, several people had lucky escapes. And in the end, the person was very unlucky who was on his own. And he drove up that road and Andrew saw him, saw that he was isolated and followed him. It's pure predatory hunting of people for a car. And it's absolute, like, these people are nothing to me except to get away. Like, I don't feel anything for them. Like, it could have been a woman, could have been anyone. He went for the guy who was on his own, who went up that thing. And that lack of humanity there is really, as you say, terrifying. And it's, you know, even just talking about it, I can feel it's tense. You can just, you know, because you can just picture that person on the bank looking over the the leaflet, and your instant reaction is with some guy as a tourist. Actually, he's assessing whether you're the person he's killed. You know.
And to me, that's even more scary. You know, in most movies, the serial killer or the killer looks like a killer. You know, and the fact that he had such a simple, preppy look with the glasses and everything, it to me, that's even more scary, you know, the way that that's played.
Yeah, no, I mean, this is the reason, like, you know, I just as a point of, you know, just the reason I would say he's a spree killer is partly because serial killers have such a pathology that is so distorted from an early age, mm-hmm. whereas this guy... You know, when he's at school, particularly, I see a lot of myself in him, like trying to be, you know, like a big shot, you know, using, I don't know, fancy phrases, trying to impress people. You want to make your mark on the world. And, you know, there were lots of elements about what he did where he was genuinely witty. He was like this Oscar Wilde, like, wit. And, you know, this sense that he looked out in the world and, you know, I go back to this Barney Frank phrase, you know, this is the guy, and he is very different to me on this front. Like, his one ambition in this world was to be impressive. And he's born into a group of people who are the most despised, some of the most despised in society. Yeah. And that fundamental contradiction is just completely destructive in his brain. He can't manage to get around it. You know, you go back far enough in his life, then you can see elements of yourself, rather than when you look at, say, Dharma, who was drinking really heavily aged 11 or 12, whenever it was, and killing animals in the forest, and, you know, that kind of crazy stuff. You look at that and you go, well, that's got nothing to do with me. I can't, you know, that's, you know, that's very early damage that is kind of impossible to fix. Whereas Andrew, you can really go back very, you know, not even that far. Like, you go back even 6 months before the murders, you could have stopped it somehow, you feel.
Interesting. Interesting. No, that's an interesting way to look at it. I didn't think about Dahmer in that type of way, that it came from childhood, whereas his came later in his life. So you don't think it was in him that he was going to become... Do you really think that he could have stopped and it would have never happened at some point?
It's interesting. Like, I think if you take out any of the elements, if you take out... you know, if you take out the fact that he lost all his money, if he was still rich, he wouldn't have killed. If you take out the crystal meth addiction, I don't think he would have killed. If you had given him a love story, I don't think he would have killed. Mm-hmm. But he lost everything. You needed all of the things to fall for him. It basically had a complete breakdown. And having gone into this breakdown, he killed the two people closest to him. So... Mm-hmm. That was Jeff and David. Mm-hmm. And then once he crossed the line, once he'd crossed that line, he was like, you know, particularly after David, when he killed him by the lake, he's like, what shall I do now that I'm the killer? I can't go back. I can't go to prison. I'm too vain to go to prison. So now I'm going to start telling these stories. And so Miglin and Versace are these two storytellers, his version of trying to say something to the world, trying to out-lead Miglin and trying to rip down the success of Versace and say, you know, he's speaking to us.
So at some point he became an escort in real life too?
Yeah.
So do you know where did that shift come in? Was it through his ability to take advantage of people, or was that just a need what do you think that came from?
I think it came from the fact that from an early age he had relations with older men.
Okay.
And there's speculation that he had a sexual relationship with his dad. It is speculative, denied by, it's hinted at in our episode 8. We don't have confirmations. We just leave it to the audience to decide. But if you look at the way he deals with the world, he's in search of his dad. His dad gave him everything, said he was special. He didn't have to work for it. He was just adored by his father. Mm-hmm. And, you know, whether there was a sexual element in that or not, it looks like he's trying to find that relationship in the real world. And one of the ways he then started looking at was older men, and he would be treated as a kind of prince, and he would have sexual relations with them. And so some of it was not an escort in the sense that it was... clearly an exchange of money. Some of it was sort of subtler, you know, gifts and things like that. And then he tried to professionalize it. And interestingly, he got rebuffed because he was told that his race made him unappealing. and he was told that he didn't have the attributes that he needed, and there was a sense of him being ranked on this scale of what is desirable or not, and he didn't fit into the right box, so he was basically like, you know, I don't care what you say, I'm going to find out my own way of professionalizing this, which is why he managed to use his intelligence and wit and his knowledge of culture to impress these older men who didn't want a kind of bimbo escort by their side because it's embarrassing. They wanted to turn up at a gallery opening and have someone who knew what they were talking about. So he created his own position there. It was like, it was impressive. It was like he was told by the escort world no, so he was like, well, fine, I'll do it my own way. And that's what he did with these older men. So that was the journey. And, you know, I think that, you know, that rage, it's not to me, it's not a coincidence to me that his final two killings are these older men.
Right.
It's like on some level he thinks that he was owed something. On some level, I think the person he could have killed a sixth person, it would have been his dad. And that's what we found out in the episode. In a way, this whole destruction is about trying to get to your dad. That's what the sort of shape of the story is.
Okay, yeah, I could see that. That totally makes sense. That totally makes sense. Huh. Interesting.
And we're kind of playing on the, you know, that sense of dad and daddy, you know, in Cunanan, that is pushed to be the same.
Right.
That makes sense.
Totally. Huh. Interesting. Where did he get the whole thing for the S&M and the bondage and the, you know, that way of treating his victims? Was that from another, is that something he built on or gained?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, that's, I think that was something, there's source material for that, like all of the duct tape. And the interesting thing about the duct tape, and it's a special duct tape, by the way, everyone's like, why doesn't everyone's hair come off with this duct tape?
Right.
But this is special duct tape that you wrap around here. It doesn't stick.
Oh, we've practiced, have we?
I'm
messing with you.
I'm not gonna deny that we've had many tape conversations. The question is whether they happened before the show or after. I'm gonna leave that as ambiguous. But like, no, we had like, and I had this image, like this thing. This is the thing with Andrew, like that you wrap around your head. It's like a fetish stuff that you can buy. It doesn't take off your hair. But the image of Andrew's head wrapped in that duct tape. He's like a brain in search of an identity. He's like, he's putting on all these different faces and all these different, he's like this mind, this really intense mind who never locked into an identity he was happy with.
Yeah.
But in the actual sort of, you know, the actual sort of reality is that, I think he started, when his life started to crumble, having these fantasies about controlling people.
Right.
I, it's this thing of, I feel inadequate in my own life. Whereas lots of S&M relationships, actually they're about, you know, very respectful, like you have a real sense of, you would never go too far. It's all about understanding what people want. His was this completely distorted version, which is, I want to completely dominate someone. That will make me feel powerful. And he kept talking about like this fantasy of dominating someone. And the Lee Miglin murder is actually that fantasy enacted. He has complete physical control over this individual. And what's interesting is, I mean, it's horrific, but what's interesting when you look at that is he never tries it again. Like, he goes to Miami, he's there for 2 months, and he could have done that to someone else, and he didn't. And so what he realizes actually, that isn't what I was missing.
Sorry to interrupt you, but there was the guy he met on the beach, right?
Yeah, I mean, that is, but he doesn't kill him.
Right. I'm sorry.
It was just like the only source material we have for that is we know that he was an escort in Miami. He was trying to earn money for drugs. Okay. And there was source material from that guy, Ronnie, who's real, played by Max Greenfield. He said, yeah, I saw him go off with older guys. And so we just had to imagine that, what that encounter was. And one of the things I wanted to get in, which is the danger of living in the closet, is that if someone is clearly unhinged, and you would know, like in that interaction, this person is dangerous, whether Andrew stole from them or whatever he did to those people, which we don't know, those people are not going to call the cops.
Right.
Because how are they going to write that report? And so there's that sense of the closet, you know, the reason then Versace, had they called the cops, Versace wouldn't have died. So that's, you know, one of the elements we put in. But we had to project into that space. We don't know what happened in that encounter.
Now, that's That no, that's okay. I buy that. That makes sense. Interesting. Yeah, I could talk to you about this all day. This is interesting. No, really. It's probably just about character, you know, it's just so much of that in this particular story. And let me ask you a question off the subject. So how does your family feel about the type of stuff you write?
My family love it.
Yeah?
They love it. Yeah, they really love this. What do they think? I don't know whether they have. My family, I said earlier, my mom's Swedish. Mm-hmm. And in Sweden, they have an interesting rating system, which is sex. It's kids can watch sex on TV. It's right. Not really given a high rating, but violence is very high. They have a complete sort of separation of the two things. Mm-hmm. Very different balance. And I think the sex stuff they've never had an issue with, and the violence to me is, I guess it's dark. I guess there is a darkness to it, but occasionally people ask me, they look at me askew, I guess. But really, it's about intensity. I just find, you know, lots of the things I write about has a kind of intensity rather than necessarily seeing it as darkness.
Right.
You know, I think this is a story. I want, you know, the Versace story is dark, but it's full of just these incredible figures that are life forces. I mean, I finally Miglin, extraordinary David, Jeff, Versace. Mm-hmm. Yeah. They have this, and Marilyn Miglin, these people are just amazing people. And I would, you know, they're the kind of energy. And Andrew was going to, was this whirlwind of destruction through these life forces. So mm-hmm. the contrast is there for me.
Well, I was asking you that question just because I was curious. You know, it's, you know, these crime thrillers are definitely a strength of yours. You tend to write about them in your novels, you know, so it's definitely there. So I'm always curious of, you know, who's the mind behind, you know, said story. I was thinking about something else about, you know, in thinking about character and thinking about moments. There's moments in the story, and we'll use, is it David was his ex? Is that who it was, Andrews?
Yeah.
We'll use that character as an example. After he kills the other guy, now some people would be like, well, why the fuck didn't he just get out, right? But he killed him in such a way that you would be scared of him. You know, one of the things I hate in most TV shows and movies is the not believable moment of why somebody would stay. To me, I thought you earned it.
Yeah, I mean, first of all, we know that he did stay. I mean, we know that Andrew and David were together for, I think it's almost 5 days.
Yeah, it was almost a week, right?
It's almost, yeah. I mean, we compress it slightly in the show, not because of any reason other than it just has a feel that it's shorter.
Sure.
But, you know, they were together, you know, I think they were together in the flat for 2 days. And you've got to remember that our lives are going along in this direction. And David was like, had never done anything violent to anyone. He was like a really great, great, good guy. Everyone loved him. You can see like video of his friends talking about him. Like he was adored.
Right.
And suddenly to have this horrific murder in his apartment, it's like your life and your life has changed. Like it's gone on a different, you can't sort of step outside of it now. And I think I think what we're trying to get across is this sense of as a gay man in the 90s, you have this terrible fear that the thing that you do in your bedroom, if anyone could open the door and see it, they would be appalled and disgusted, and they would think you were an awful person. You grow up with that. And suddenly, in his apartment, there's a dead body. So when the door opens, everyone's appalled and disgusted. He's like, it locks into this very elemental sense of shame that you have.
Mm-hmm.
And the fact is that he was Andrew's sexual partner. There was kinky stuff in his drawers.
Yeah.
When the police turned up, they did presume he was guilty.
Right.
So actually, everything Andrew could have used as psychological warfare on David was true. He had a very effective argument, which is the police are not going to believe you.
Right.
And the police didn't believe him. The police actually held him open as a suspect for a year after that crime. It was only a year later the parent managed to clear his name.
Yeah.
What a sort of, you know, incredible injustice that was. And that sense, there's a moment which is a projected moment, which is when David is on the run with Andrew. And what you're doing there is you're hiding from the reality that your life has changed completely and that you're going to have to face up to the police and they're going to be hostile and they're going to presume that you're guilty. And he's hiding from that. And he looks out, and we always think when we're with, you know, when you see it in a thriller, when you're with a killer, that you're desperate to escape, and if you could just crawl away, the police would welcome you with, you know, a blanket and, a, you know, like a drink, and then be like, it's all over. But the truth is, and David knew this, the police wouldn't welcome him with that blanket. He would go straight into a cell, and he would get questioned, and he would get interrogated, and he would probably get charged with that murder of Jeff, or as either as some involvement, and that he would probably be found guilty. And so he looks out in this moment at the window, and he looks at the free world, and he looks at freedom, and says, it's not for me. You know, I'd rather hide in this bubble that Andrew has created for a little bit longer. But we then know that eventually he did challenge it and said, listen, I can't live the lie that you want me to lead. I have to confront the fact that we have to go to the police. We have to tell them. We have to make our case. We have to tell them the truth. And that is what is such a courageous act in a sense. And we know that, by the way, from the injuries. We know that he was face-to-face to Andrew. We know that there was he was begging for his life. And we know that Andrew, being a narcissist, wouldn't have killed him if David was still saying, oh, let's go off to Mexico. I'm still in love with you. David must have said no more. That must have been the trigger for Andrew.
And I think you hinted around to that, you know, when I think right before they had to, you know, sneak off out of there. I think he was like, no. Like, we're going, and he always threatened them with something else that raised the bar. You know, that's what I got. One of the things I was going to talk about was, and I appreciate you taking so much time, is, like, a lot of people who hate themselves or whatever they're going through, like, a lot of people will cut themselves. I was thinking about this, and I'm sure you probably, I don't know if you thought about this or not. Whenever Andrew would put the tape over his head, I thought it was almost like him, it was like him punishing himself.
I think he had a deep sense of unhappiness. He said it at some point. Right. I mean, he was not oblivious. There were times where he could be honest and he would say to people, I'm unhappy. I'm really, I mean, one of the things actually that we couldn't do because we could never track it because of the way we were shot is that his body shape fluctuated enormously. At school, where he was doing lots of running, he was lean and he had a good physique. He gained and became an addict. He lost it all again when he was in Miami. So his body weight was all over the place. His sense, I mean, that was real eating because he was unhappy. It was this real sense of, I need to get pleasure. I need to get satisfaction from food I can't really afford, like very expensive meals, very expensive wines. So all of this, there was a lot of trying to self-medicate his sadness away. He never inflicted physical pain like cutting. But you're right, there's that tape stuff and the shaving of the hair eventually, and his image becomes, his look becomes very stark. And there's all kinds of, there's lots of the physicality we could only do a little of because we just, you know, he was so up and down, and so all over the place, and they would change from month to month.
Okay. Interesting. Yeah, I didn't have an issue with that at all. One of the things I loved about it is I felt like the timeline, even though you gave us the dates and everything, which I thought was really appropriate, it made it feel like everything was going fast, like you said, like as if the entire show happened over a week or two. You know what I mean? That's the way it really felt, like things were just zooming by because he was going from state to state and on his way to Florida, you know, which I believe was his last stop. So that I found, you know, like it always had like a ticking clock going on, if you will. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I mean, I think that ticking clock, obviously it happens once the killings start, you have that the rhythm of being on the run.
Right.
But actually, I think you're right, there's a ticking clock before the killing. Like, this person is descending. Like, there is this high point of his life where he's at school and he's adored and he's, the world is his oyster. He's clever. He does have he has a great education. I mean, you know, and there's this crumbling. And I remember reading Maureen's book and there is this, I felt like, oh my God, this life is unraveling. And you're trying, you know, you want it not to fall apart, regardless of whether I find it vain or narcissistic or whatever. I don't want him to fall apart because I know what that falling apart means, which is the loss of all these great people. And there is that, I felt incredible sense of, you know, we talk about when you're writing a thriller, you're dealing with that tension, the tension of someone's life unraveling. And yeah, there's that really is that comes through in, I think, episode 6, which is the Descent episode, where he has the world, you know, he has that beautiful house in La Jolla, he has an allowance, he has, you know, he has what he wants, and it crumbles, it all falls away, and you know when it's falling away, this is not just someone who's going to end up in a smaller apartment, this is someone who can't live in that small apartment, who's going to destruct and explode, and that explosion is going to consume these lives.
Right. Well, you guys did an excellent job on the show, and I seriously encourage everybody out there to watch it if you guys haven't watched it yet. It's freaking amazing. It's a class on writing a thriller for sure, and it's a class on character, in my opinion. You know, really, really nails it. Really nails it. So, what's next for you? What you got going on next? What's up?
I'm doing a show called Mother, Father, Son, which is that's all one word, and it's BBC Two. Starts filming in June. It's 8 episodes. That's like an intense family saga that is set against the backdrop of politics and the press in the UK with a US lead as well. So it's like this family, the mother, father, and the son are the three main characters. Okay. Again, that's about people, really. It's about people and power. And there is, it's intense again. Let's put it that way. No murders.
Oh, I'll never watch that one then. That's
there
awesome.
Might be one murder.
That's hilarious. Well, thanks so much, man. I appreciate it. Hey, question for you: are you on Twitter, Instagram? Can people follow you anywhere? Where are you at?
Yeah, I'm Twitter. I'm on Twitter, yeah. Tom Rob Smith on Twitter. Mm-hmm. Follow me. I don't know. I'm occasionally. I don't really talk about writing and about show. I don't talk about the world.
Mm-hmm.
It's, you know, I don't have millions of world views. I guess I do, but I don't really put them out there. So it's a very kind of worky Twitter thing. But I respond to everyone. Everyone, like, there's been some really lovely messages, and I try and, you know, answer any questions or whatever on Twitter.
Awesome. That's what's up. Well, cool. Well, thanks so much, everybody. Tom Rob Smith, everybody. That was awesome. Hey, man, enjoy yourself. Keep writing good shit. And, good luck to you. Best of luck to you. Thank you very much.
All right, mate. Talking to you.
Cheers. Peace.
Many thanks to Hilliard and Tom for joining the conversation here on Third and Fairfax. If you have comments or questions, you can always send us an email, podcast@wga.org. For Aaron Fullerton, Steve Troutman, Monique Sorgan, and the entire WGA podcast team, thanks for listening.